Populism is the reaction to these economic and structural changes, and these changes will not go away.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Jacqueline Delarier. Populist leaders and movements are on the rise across the world. Why now? Populism has been around since ancient Rome, but two major modern influences are actually driving the recent resurgence: the global financial crisis over a decade ago and technology.
Globalization and technology will make the cleavage between more educated and less educated individuals more and more relevant. And as long as these trends continue, these sources of conflict will remain.
Economist Guido Tabellini says people now vote more along cultural identity lines, not based on whether they're rich or poor. It's the nationalists versus the cosmopolitans. And with inequality high and rising, more people feel excluded and are voting very differently than they used to. In this episode, we explore the puzzle of populism with Professor Tabellini, who sat down with us when he was at the IMF to deliver the annual Richard Good Lecture based on his research. Professor Tabellini, thank you very much for joining us today. What is populism, and why should economists care about it?
So populism is meant to be a political movement which has some particular features. As the word says, it's support for the people with a distrust of the intermediating political elites. So the populist politicians claim to represent a homogeneous population whose interests have been neglected by the mainstream politicians. But besides this rhetorical element, there are other things in common. In particular, many of the populist parties that have gained influence and visibility are on the social conservative position. So there has been a change in the dimensions of political conflict. Populists can be of the left and of the right. They often on the right, but they almost uniformly tend to be socially conservative. So that's another distinguishing feature of populist parties. They are anti-establishment, socially conservative, and often advocate untested and radical solution. Why should we be concerned? Well, that's a very important transformation of the political system of democracies. For over a century, the conflict has always been on the left to right dimension, and now we are seeing new dimensions of political conflict and new parties that enter the political system. So it's an important change.
These new dimensions, we see them globally today, but populism has been around since ancient Rome. That's not new. So why is it on the rise across the world today?
So you're right. It's not new. There have been episodes in advanced democracies and in Latin America where populists gained office and were influential. What is happening now, which is similar to the past, is that this political transformation tend to happen when the economy is changing rapidly, like now due to technology or globalizations. And also, they tend to be correlated with the occurrence of financial crises. We have seen over a century that financial crises are often followed by radicalization of political conflicts, a shift to the right, and the emergence of new radical parties.
And what is at the heart of that connection between a crisis and radicalization?
So I think probably it's disappointed expectations. So adverse shocks, which are unexpected and large, like a financial crisis, or transformations of the economic structure are leaving people behind, and people with unfulfilled expectations are reacting, searching for something new. So I think there is a lot of evidence that there is a tight connection between economic adversity and the rise of these populist movements.
You use the word disappointment. What should politicians and policymakers do differently?
Well, it's easier said than done. It should be to protect the losers from these transformations and these shocks. Often the disappointed are not necessarily the poorest element of society. They may be, but not always. And so one should pay attention to the nature of these shocks that are creating these adversities. And in the current circumstances, they are often related to education, because the less educated are on the losing side of these transformations. And they are also geographically concentrated because of agglomeration economies. Areas specialize in some sectors, and then the sector is hit by a shock due to imports or technology, and the whole area suffers. So there is an important dimension of regional inequality which is associated with this. So what to do? Pay attention to these elements of regional inequality and help the people with less education to find new economic opportunities.
And the inequality of income and the inequality of wealth is a huge, perhaps, part of this. You've referred to the puzzle of populism. Can you tell us a bit more about what are the pieces of that puzzle?
Yeah, so if it is true, as I'm saying, that the rise of populism is associated with economic shocks and inequality, you would expect that losers demand protection from the state and vote left, because typically the left has been the political side that helped redistribution.
The political left, you mean?
The political left. And this is not happening. So the puzzle is that now, instead, we are seeing economic shocks, and those hit by the shocks, rather than seeking protection from redistribution, more welfare state, and voting social democratic parties, demand control of immigration, socially conservative policies, and support platforms, policy platforms, that often induce a retrenchment of the welfare state rather than a widening. So that's the puzzle. Why is it that these economic shocks and the losers from the economic shocks demand policies that don't seem to be the right policies for them? And maybe we shouldn't be lecturing to them. Maybe they are the right policies. But in my lecture, I suggest two answers to this puzzle. One is that disappointment brings with it a preference for risk or for something new, because you've been disappointed by the status quo, and so you welcome new politicians who offer radical solutions, because maybe you've lost already so much that you don't have much more to lose, and this novelty can offer some chance of redemption for you. So that's one element. Disappointment induces a preference for political risk-taking. And the second element is that the losers from these shocks, because they are less educated and they live in typically in areas which are more provincial, less integrated with the world economy, tend to be more socially conservative. And so these shocks induce new social identities, increase the cohesion of a local community, which may be good. But what distinguishes this local community, besides being hit by the shock, is its conservatism on social issues like immigration, civil rights. And so these new social identities tend to induce people to see the world through a glass that puts them against the elite, against the cosmopolitan elite. And once you see the world in that way, then it becomes natural for you to demand control of immigration and to exacerbate cultural conflict. And so the idea is that an economic shock can spill over into demand for seemingly unrelated policies because of the identity switches that are induced by these new cleavages in society.
You've also written about the role of social media in shaping the rise of populism. Tell us more about what that role is. Like, how does it work in practice?
Yeah, that's a very important aspect of these changes. I would point to a number of effects. One effect is the disintermediation of the news. So in the past, information was intermediated and filtered by media, and now this is no longer happening, or it's happening much less. Why is this important? Well, it reduces the barriers to entry of new political forces, and it also changes the nature of the political propaganda, because certain overly simplistic messages or blatant falsehoods would be filtered out by the media, now no longer. So the type of propaganda and messages that is allowed not only facilitates new entrants, but also changes somehow the nature of the political debate. The second aspect that I would want to emphasize is what political scientists have called echo chambers. So we tend to all select news that confirm our prior beliefs. And so this has led to arguably an increase in the polarization of views, and that can explain another recent phenomenon, which is this perception of greater divisions in society. And that's because we are exposed to more different news as individuals than we used to be. The third and final aspects that I would mention is how these social media are amplifying the phenomena that I was describing before of social identities. So once I share something in common with a group of people, I am going to be more exposed to their views. And so social media can amplify not only polarizations, but also belief distortions associated with these social identities. The idea here is that if I identify with a social group, I depersonalize, I tend to behave like a typical member of the group. So there is both increased polarization, but also increased possibilities of having very distorted beliefs about reality through this mechanism of social identifications. And we have seen in some of our research that the effects of the shocks that I described before, the trade shocks, the technology shocks, are stronger in terms of changing views of the world on the individuals who are more exposed to social media and make a greater use of the media, confirming this conjecture.
So what should global institutions like the IMF, but of course many others, do to help people who feel that their institutions, their governments, left them behind or excluded them or certainly failed to include them in the benefits of globalization?
Now, that's a very important question. And I think what we are seeing now, one can argue, is a reaction to excesses that maybe we did in designing the scope of these supranational organizations or institutions. Let me explain. So the way in which European integration was built was on the principle of market integration, expanding the market and inducing countries to compete. Because by having competition between countries and systems, you would improve economic efficiency. And economists were very much pushing this idea. Why has it gone too far? Well, because we realize now that this competition between systems is imposing constraints on the ability of government to pursue domestic goals of redistribution and protecting the losers. Let me give you an example. A state aid policy prevents countries in Europe from assisting for a long time areas in decline or providing state aid to firms, because that would distort competition, which of course is true from an economic perspective, but it adds constraints to the ability of government to protect the losers. Another perhaps more important example is tax competition. So mobility of capital is inducing a race to the bottom in taxation of wealth and capital. This increases efficiency, but reduces the ability of states to redistribute. And in a world that is becoming more global and with problems that are more at the global level, there is no reason why supranational institutions should be playing the role of constraining governments. In principle, they should have the opposite role of empowering governments to achieve their domestic goals. So that's the sense in which the new populist movement are suggesting that maybe there is a role for international organizations and supranational institutions that we should rethink. Not just market integration, not just competition and efficiency, also empowering nation states to protect the losers. And I think there is room to improve very much in that dimension.
So is your view that populism is here to stay?
I think it is. I think if I'm right, populism is the reaction to these economic and structural changes. These changes will not go away. They will, if anything, increase. Globalization technology will make the cleavage between more educated and less educated individuals more and more relevant. It will increase polarization within countries. We are seeing this happening. And as long as these trends continue, these sources of conflict will remain relevant. And what we are seeing now, I think, in many advanced democracies and other countries is an adjustment of the party systems and the political systems to these new conflicts. And so it will remain, it will require important solutions.
Professor Tabellini, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Guido Tabellini is a professor of political economics at Bocconi University in Milan, Italy. His recent working paper on identity, beliefs, and political conflict is published on his personal page on the university's website. You can watch the video of his Richard Good lecture at imf.org. And if you like what you're hearing, subscribe to IMF Podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.